At this time, I would like to welcome, it's a great honor to welcome our first speaker this morning who came from the East Coast, from Teaneck, New Jersey this morning, Rabbi Kenneth Brander, who is the Dean of the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. As all of you know, the CJF, the Center for the Jewish Future, is our chief partner, along with the Torah Mitzion, our chief partner in bringing this goal to fruition. The fact is that the Center for the Jewish Future provided a lot of the inspiration in terms of forging this partnership to begin with, and that's the reason that I'm here, and it's the reason for the continuing success of the Kol, thank God, is a lot of continued support on many different levels. So we appreciate Rabbi Brander's presence, not just as a scholar, as a Malame Torah, but also as someone who really steers the ship of the CJF, which is enabling us to run such an outstanding program. So we thank him for that. He is also the Rabbi Emeritus of the Boca Raton Synagogue in Florida. As many of you know, Boca Raton is now one of the upcoming premier Jewish communities of the North American scene, and that's largely due to Rabbi Brander's more than 10 years of putting his leif and nefesh, creating not just the mikveh, not just the day school, the high school, also the kolo there. That was his vision. But today, he plays another role, and for me particularly, it's an important role, because in this regard, as well as many other regards, I am a student of Rabbi Brander. Because among the myriad of incredible programs that Rabbi Brander has run at YU since he came, when I was first out of Smicha, he ran a one-year program, I assume you haven't forgotten this yet, for a bunch of young rabbis. I was younger at the time. And it was a program on infertility and halacha, which is one of Rabbi Brander's subspecialties. He has trained extensively in Machon Puah, which is led by Rav Menachem Bershtein, for those of you who know a little bit about Machon Puah. And he has special ordination from Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Shlita, the former chief rabbi of Israel, in this issue, in these issues, this whole area, this constellation of halachic and medical challenges known as infertility. So Rabbi Brander organized an entire year-long course that he directed for us, and he shared with us incredible insight, a breadth of knowledge, and a great sensitivity. And therefore, I think it's an outstanding choice of topic for Rabbi Brander to share with us some of his reflections, halachic and medical, from outside observations on an interesting, a very fascinating question in halacha and medical ethics. And who better to speak about it than the Dean of the Center for the Jewish Future, Rabbi Kenneth Brander.
Thank you, Rabbi Brand. Rishut, with the permission of the Mora D'Asra, Rabbi Engel, with a dear friend and mentor and colleague, Rabbi Freundel, you're in great hands on any issue of Erevin with Rabbi Freundel, or for that matter, any issue of Geirus, or most halachic issues with Rabbi Freundel. And to the Rosh Kollel, to Rabbi Brand, first a mazel tov to Rabbi and Dr. Brand, on the recent birth of another child. In the spirit of all that both of you do, may you be zochet that all of your children should have your passion for Torah mitzvot and your commitment to Klal Yisrael. It's a true privilege to be in Chicago here today, albeit for just a brief time. And you know, a few years ago, we had conversations with some of you around this room. I even remember some of the faces for that Saturday night evening in which we talked about this kollel. And you know, now it's a year later. We all have grown from the experience. And Baruch Hashem, I think that it's fair to say that Chicago has benefited greatly from this kollel. And I know that our students who make up this kollel have benefited greatly. And this now becomes a incubator for us to continue to develop, not only within the larger Chicago community, but also in particular in other parts of the country. Emeritus Hashem, we plan to launch another kollel in the Toronto area in stages over the next year or so. There's around 40 other places that have asked us to launch kollelim there. We have no intention of launching 40 kollelim. Unless Rabbi Brand wants to be in charge of all 40, I have no intention of launching all 40. But we'll launch a few at a time. learning from our experiences, and please God, being able to share the Torah of Yeshiva University, the Torah of Torah Mitzion, in appropriate ways throughout North America. And again, as I started, I conclude my introduction with, it's such a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Engel and to be able to have this new partnership with Rabbi Engel. Rabbi Engel came after the Kol began, but in the short period of time that he's been here, he's already lent great support to the Kol, and there's a really good feeling to know that you have a chaver on the ground, so when there are issues, you can turn to people who have not only a depth of knowledge, but a depth of understanding of community, and understand the larger community, and he's not only a Mor D'Asra for his synagogue, he's really a community rav. As Rabbi Brand mentioned, during the time that I was in Boca Raton, I started getting a lot of shilas from young couples about various issues of infertility. And I felt at a loss because my capacity to answer those shilas was quite limited. So I decided that during the sabbatical that was awarded to me that I would take 6-7 months and just sit and learn these halachot and eventually sit on the basin of... a few basins of the Eda Charedis and the basin in Bnei Brak and others, and eventually received smicha from Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, take bechinas from him in these issues. And the particular issue that I was asked to discuss today is an issue that focuses on the whole notion of pre-implementation genetic diagnosis, PGD, and essentially, just to make sure that we're all up on the same page, essentially what that means is the following. And let me start off with a story. In my in the first year or so that I was at Yeshiva University, I was asked to speak at Bar Ilan on a few topics of medical ethics. Yeshiva University arranged for me to be interviewed on Israeli television. I'm being interviewed on Israeli television, challenging enough to be able to respond to these issues in Hebrew, although I learned all these medical terms at first, really just in Hebrew. And the person interviewing me asked me the following question. It was a true case. There was a young couple. There was a couple in Mea Shearim, and again, I'm not trying to be stereotypical. I'm just giving the topic, the case as it was. There was a couple in Mea Shearim, where the husband and wife wanted to actualize the dream of having a family, could not, and they eventually came to the conclusion that the reason they could not actualize that dream is because the husband had no sperm. There's a whole protocol of exactly how you check for certain issues of infertility from a halachic perspective. That's the last checks that are done. It's Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Moshe Feinstein, others discuss this in much greater depth. When they decided that they were going to use a donor sperm, and the halacha is that when you do that, you use a non-Jew's donor sperm, as Rav Moshe Feinstein, as well as... Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal, both right. Rav Moshe Feinstein's house actually was firebombed for that tshuva. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach actually wrote the same tshuva, but it was not in a very popular thing. It was in a journal called Noam, which not too many people read. It was in the first volume of Noam, but since it was, you know, not as popular as Igris Moshe, he nothing happened to his home, and what happened was that as they're doing the procedure, what's called IVF, in vitro fertilization, which essentially, if you open up your handout, you'll see that it discusses it a little bit.
Does anybody not have?
Essentially, what a vitro fertilization is the following: if there are many ways. In order to help fertility, a couple actualize the dream of having children. IVF is a much more aggressive way. There is something called IUI, intrauterine insemination. There is sometimes using certain medications like Clomid. Sometimes there are certain blockages. Sometimes there can be what's called endometriitis. There can be other challenges. But one of the last stages in the process of fertility is doing what we call an IVF. And what IVF means is that essentially the fertilization of the egg happens outside of the womb. So what happens is you take the sperm, and again, I'm really doing this on a very elementary level, so there are doctors in the room, I apologize, and I'm just really doing this very fast. That essentially, you take the sperm and the egg meet within an appropriate environment within the laboratory, a petri dish of some sort, and what happens is that hopefully one of the sperm penetrates the egg, and fertilizes the egg, and thus you begin the development of the fertilized egg. And in the third or fourth day of its development, what's called the blastocyst stage of development, you choose the appropriate fertilized eggs, the ones that look the best, and you return them into the womb of the woman. Depending how old the woman is, and other issues, you might decide how many to return. But that's why a lot of times when people go through fertility processes, they'll have not just one child, but multiple children. Octomom is one of the primary examples of over the top, in my opinion, an abuse of fertilization procedures. But what happens is that's what IVF is. You can do what's called a more aggressive IVF if you're concerned that the sperm is not of the top quality, or a woman's a little bit older, and therefore the shell of the egg, sometimes it's harder to penetrate. What you can do is what's called an ICSI IVF, in which what you essentially do is, instead of allowing the sperm to find its own way to the egg, essentially what you do is you force the sperm into the egg by, if you look at the diagrams that I have in front of you, the top left-hand diagram is a standard IVF procedure where the sperm hopefully binds with the egg. An ICSI IVF procedure is when essentially you force a sperm, but you hold the egg. Look at your bottom picture. You see that the egg on the left-hand side is being held by a certain tool, and then you'll see almost like a little needle that has the sperm in it, and it penetrates into the egg, forcing it to fertilize. And eventually what you have is what you see on the next page of your handout, and that is an egg that is fertilized, and that's what you see in the top right-hand corner. There is a new stage that now can be done. It's not so new. It's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD, where essentially at the stage of blastocyst, you can pull one of the cells away from this fertilized egg. It doesn't hurt the fertilized egg. It will just continue to grow and grow with more cells. You just remove one of the cells, and from that cell, you really have a window into an encyclopedic window into all of the genetic makeup of the child. You can tell whether the child's going to be a boy or a girl. You can tell a whole bunch of other things. So let me now continue the story. The story continues that the guy said, I don't want any male children. I only want female children. Why? Because he, in Me'er She'arim, he's a Kohen. His child will be bar mitzvah. At the bar mitzvah, he'll get maftir, so no one's going to know the difference. The day after the bar mitzvah, when there's brichas kohanim, or even before then, and all of a sudden the child doesn't go up, because it doesn't go up to the aliyah l'duchan, right? Does not do nesiat kapayim. Because everybody holds that if the definition of paternity from this perspective is the sperm donor, he's a Yisrael. So he's concerned about the embarrassment that he'll have regarding the fact that he'll have this nice child, but the child will never be perceived as his because the child will be viewed as Yisrael. He'll get, he won't even wash his father's hands, even though in Eretz Yisrael, rarely, as a Kohen, rarely does anyone ever wash your hands. But the bottom line is that he did not want to have boys for the reason I just articulated. So he asked that at Bikkurholm Hospital, which for obvious reasons has a wonderful infertility clinic because it's so close to Me'er She'arim and Geula, which uses these protocols. The nice thing about the infertility clinics in Israel is that it's one place in which all religious issues are left at the door. Because everybody, whether you're from a Shomer HaTzair kibbutz, or whether you're from Geula, you're all interested in procreating and having children. And therefore, it's interesting to watch. You could have somebody asking you from a person who mamish doesn't eat kosher at all, but wants to make sure that their children are halachically fitting within the certain protocols, they'll ask you shaylas. And you'll have someone from the Eidah Haredis community also asking you shaylas. And what's interesting is he didn't want to have any children that were male. He only wanted to have female children. So with PGD, this pre-implementation genetic diagnosis, you can do an IVF procedure. And what you can easily do is you can decide which fertilized eggs are male, are going to be male, which ones are going to be female. The question is, halakhically, can you decide to throw out all the male eggs, all the ones that will bring you male children, and decide to keep all those that will bring you female children? Returning to the womb, let's say two or so, depending on the age of the woman, two. And perhaps if there's a few extra, freezing them for future, in case the husband and wife want to have future children, fertilized eggs can be cryopreserved for an extended period of time. Sperm can be cryopreserved, you know, for at least one lifetime. And so the question is, you know, can you do this? Can you decide you want male or female children? Or, I'll give you an example that happened last week. Someone comes in from, we push at YU now that all students should have genetic testing. Whether you use Dor Yesharim or open testing, YU has moved, the Rosh Yeshivas have moved from a perspective of moving from what was called closed testing, Dor Yesharim, to open testing. Again, time does not allow me to explain the virtues of open testing other than you know what you're doing, other than you have all the facts in front of you. But we create testing opportunities, both open and closed testing, right? So the bottom line is that we have easily every year 500 to 600 young men and young women who go through a testing process. Why? Because we want, before dating, for people to understand if they have any genetic challenges and how to deal with some of those genetic challenges. So a few weeks ago, a young man and young woman come into my office. They both have they're both carriers of the gene for Tay-Sachs. They're very serious at this point in time. Their parents do not want them to get engaged or married. They want to get engaged and married. And what they will do is, before they have children, they will have all their children through IVF, in vitro fertilization. They'll fertilize the egg in the lab. They'll look at this blastocyst stage of development, page 2 of your handout. They'll pull one of the cells away, and they'll look at which fertilized eggs have Tay-Sachs and which ones don't. The ones that have Tay-Sachs, they'll destroy, assuming that's halakhically permitted to destroy them. And the ones that don't will be placed within the womb of the woman, and that's the way they'll have children. They wanted my guidance about whether that's the way they should live their life. And by the way, in New York and Chicago also, and Chicago has one of the best people in the world that works on some of this stuff, Dr. Verlinsky, if my memory serves me correctly, one of the best people. He actually has a better PGD procedure than the one I'm explaining here. He pulls the genetic matter from a different place, which again, time does not allow me to get into the full medical component, but he's unbelievable. So the question is, are you permitted to do that? Or in a case where somebody has had children with Tay-Sachs, and now they want to have, and they've lost a child through Tay-Sachs, they want to have future children, they don't want to have that challenge. Or if somebody perceives a child that is blind or deaf to be a challenge, and they want to make sure that future children that they have will not be blind or deaf or have any of the Ashkenazic genetic diseases or other genetic diseases that I have mentioned to you on the second page of the handout, can they do this PGD? Can they do pre-implementation genetic diagnosis? Or if they all have all girls and they decide they want to have a boy to be Mekayim the Mitzvah Peru Revu, or they have all boys and they said they want to have a girl to be Mekayim the Mitzvah Peru Revu. One of my colleagues who's a Rav, has five girls. He comes over and he says, what am I supposed to do? I want to have a boy. I said, PGD. I mean, but that was a joke. But the bottom line is that, halakhically, is that something that's permitted for one to do? Should one be involved in that? So I just wanted to first, before we begin to go through the halakhic issues, I just wanted to set the stage. And that is, there are various ways in which one can deal with the challenges of infertility. The most aggressive way is what is called IVF, in vitro fertilization. There is what's called ICSI IVF, which is a more aggressive form of IVF. And at a certain point, when the egg is fertilized within the lab, at the blastocyst stage of development, you can remove one cell, and it basically gives you a looking glass to various genetic traits of the future child. Are you allowed to use those traits to obviate genetic challenges, genetic anomalies, as well as to decide whether you want a male or female child, a young boy or a young girl? That's the issues that we're talking about in the whole notion of using PGD, pre-implementation genetic diagnosis. Any questions at this point in time? Yes, please.
Just, were it not for all these questions, does the doctor already try to determine before he chooses one over the other which has the best chance of survival?
Of course. That, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, before you place the egg, yes, there's no challenge with that. And sometimes you'll have another issue where sometimes the woman will be carrying multiple fetuses, and you can have a situation in which that you'll have a situation where the woman cannot carry all the fetuses. It's becoming too challenging. And what they'll have to do is they'll have to reduce one of the fetuses. And there's actually a place in Philadelphia that's well known for this. And what they'll do is they will reduce one of the fetuses in order to allow the other ones to live. There also, the doctor will make a decision based on, you know, which ones have the best capacity to live or not. But yes, in the case that you're talking about, definitely, yes, the doctor will do that. But here it's talking about, they all look great. One will be boy, one will be girl, something like that. Yes.
There are 1.5 more possibilities to help an infertile couple have a baby. I wonder if you're going to discuss them. My own interpretation is that they probably are okay from a halakhic viewpoint. One of them is cloning, because actually you don't have to use a partner for cloning. You can actually use the woman's own cells to clone a baby for her. And the other one is something called parthenogenesis, which you may or may not know about. Do you?
A little bit, but I'm talking about fertility procedures that are part and parcel of the lexicon of the of daily medical procedures of the here and now. I'm not aware that cloning, other than it being in, you know, a conversation at this point in time, is something that's being used in fertility. Cloning, I understand how cloning is used and how one, you know, can then force you remove the nucleic matter from the egg, put in the full genetic structure of the woman, and you create some type of electronic stimulation for the egg to seem like it's been fertilized and it's developed. But to the best of my knowledge, that's more in the theory yet. It's not yet in the practice.
Yeah, hopefully it's never been done in a human yet.
Right, so I'm here just to focus on one particular component. And yes, we can discuss cloning. I think there are times in which cloning is permitted. I think there is times in which cloning is great, especially when it's used for helping deal with certain illnesses on a cellular level. For example, through cloning, one can probably deal with issues like diabetes, Alzheimer's, and other issues, certain issues of paralysis. But for issues of fertility, I think there are larger issues in cloning, and I wasn't planning to get into this. I'm planning to just deal with PGD, because I have to finish by a certain time, which is 10 o'clock. Yes.
Do you mean abortion? And is
sorry?
By reduction of the fetus, do you mean abortion?
Yeah.
And does that fetus have a lot of classification for rotating?
Well, that's a great question. Again, we're in issues. Rambam is the only one that gives it a quasi-status of rodate. He calls it kirodate. No one else would call it a rodate because it's not yet a human being. But the question is, when you know for sure that by not doing this reduction that you probably will compromise all the fetuses, there is a whole series of Torah about what can be done to reduce one in order to allow the other fetuses to live.
Okay.
what is called a rode for Dr. Major Machlokes in the Rishonim, and it wouldn't just apply to the other treatises, it would probably apply how it affects the mother. Yes? Know that that due to the health of the mother or the fact that there's multiple pregnancies that she cannot hold, that you have to reduce in order to make the other one viable, then there are a lot of issues to be discussed. I was just throwing those issues out so that when you invite me another time, we can focus on those. And what we are now going to just focus particularly on one particular issue, try to drill a little deep into that for the next 20 minutes or so. And we won't be able to deal with all these issues. I teach this as part of the Smicha program at YU in the Contemporary Halakha Shir, and even the stuff we're doing, normally I teach in a period of an hour and a half to 2 hours. So we only have 20 minutes to do what we'll do with them in 2 hours. So let us move towards that. If anyone doesn't understand the medical mitzias, the medical reality of just articulated, please ask now, so then we can move further. Okay, so let's go to our handouts. Let's go to some of the sources. Okay, so in the first page of the handout, the first page past some of the diagrams, you'll find an interesting comment, and that is that there is a comment that you find throughout the Talmud and throughout Midrash that discusses the idea of how one can try to have male children over female children. And we're not going to read all of these different examples. We can just read one or two. The third one on the right-hand side. Amar Rav Chi Bar Abba, Amar Rav Yochanan, Kol Amavdil Ayayim B'Matzi Shabbos, B'Matzi Shabbosos. Anyone who wants to have male children should make sure they make Havdalah on wine on Matzi Shabbos, not on anything else. Havin Lo Badim Zcharin is guaranteed to have male children. I know a lot of people who make wine on Saturday night. And they have just female children. Then the next question is, Meisvei, look at the Gemara in Bar Basra, Maya Sa'adam, Yulo, Banim Zcharim. What should a man do in order to merit to have male children? He should give tzedakah to the poor. He should make his wife joyful in the act of having marital relations. So there's different approaches regarding this whole notion of trying to orchestrate whether one should have male or female children. However, if you turn to the next page in the handout, I think we need to set the stage for our conversation and deal with it from a more medical perspective. The first is the famous Gemara regarding a conversation between the Roman governor of Judea, Rufus, and Rabbi Akiva. This conversation is actually written about by Dr. Tversky, Zatzal, and really was discussed by Rabbi Soloveitchik in trying to understand the philosophical differences between Ternus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. Ternus Rufus says the following. He turns to Rabbi Akiva and says, you want to know why the Jewish people are condemned to Gehenna? They're condemned to Gehenna because they help the poor. Suppose a king, an earthly king, would incarcerate one of his subjects and tell everybody not to give that subject food or drink. And somebody snuck some food or drink for that incarcerated subject, that incarcerated citizen. Would not the king be angry? And you, the Jewish people, are called the servants of God. You, the Jewish people, are the servants of God, as it clearly states. And therefore, when you do this, when you're involved, you are the children of God, you are the servants of God, by you getting involved in helping the poor, which God has incarcerated in this life of poverty, you have violated God's wishes. So Rabbi Akiva says, suppose the same earthly king incarcerated not a subject, but his own child, and said, do not give my son food or drink. And somebody snuck food or drink into his child. Would not the king be happy? And we are considered the children of God. And so, what is happening here, what Rabbi Soloveitchik explains happening here is that Ternus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva are looking at the world through two different sets of lenses. Ternus Rufus says that we have to wear the lenses of God. If God condemned
this family to be poor, you don't have a right to interact. If God condemned this couple not to have children, you have no right to interact. You have no right to do anything to help this person change their status quo. Says Rabbi Kiva, we don't wear the glasses of God. We don't take a providential view on life. We don't understand how God works. We are God's partners. God created a world, and he asked us to perfect that world. We are involved in the fixing of the world, in the developing of the world. And we are called God's children. We don't look at what there is. We look at what we can do to make the world better. And so Soloveitchik said that is the real undercurrent of the conversation between Generous Rivers and Rabbi Akiva. Indeed, the Meiri, again, depending on when the Meiri lived, but it's probably in the 1200s, 1249, Jacob Katz has in one of his books, Exclusiveness and Tolerance, one of the footnotes, exactly when the Meiri lives is not so clear, but let's assume, based on the more popular understandings, he lived in 1249 or so, he has an unbelievable thing in the Second Sanhedrin, where the Meiri writes, Kosha hu nase bepula tivit eino b'klag shafim. Anything that is done through science is not considered witchcraft, magic. It's forbidden, from a Jewish perspective, to be involved in forms of witchcraft. Afilu, this is unbelievable, he writes this in the 1200s, Afilu yedu'u livroa bri'ut yafot shelo mizvug hamin. Even when there will come a time that we will learn to create human beings, not through the act of intimate sexuality, kamosha noda b'sifri hateva, she'en hadavar nimna, as we learn from the books of Sifri HaTeva, which he means Kabbalistic works, Rasha'im lasot, it is permitted to do that, shekoshahu tivi, anything that comes through a natural order, through science, eno b'klal kishuv, is not considered magic. V'domo laze amru, and this is what it means, koshi yesh bo mishum refua, ein bo mishum darkei amori. Anything that is for refua is not considered a darkei amori, is not considered acts that are prohibited. Amorite acts of magic. So these two introductory comments are just here to highlight the following. First of all, the Jewish approach to the world is to look at the world and to try to change it, to try to make it better, to try to improve it. That's number one. The second thing is that we should recognize that there is almost some type of indication, even by the Meiri, that there will come a time in which we will learn how to do these things, and it's not forbidden to be involved with this. Anything that is done through the acts of science, that is what God has given us. So that's what the Kaddish Baruch Hu has given us as a medium through which to be able to continue the creation of the world that Kaddish Baruch Hu started. In fact, but at the same time, it's also important to realize the Gemara tells us at the end of 120 years, we're asked a whole bunch of different questions. We're asked, Sepita Yeshua, did we wait for the redemption? Did we anticipate the redemption? Did we work hard for the redemption? Were we involved in trying to change the world? Did we interact in business practices appropriately? Rabbi Freundel is about to engage in a unbelievable, hopefully unbelievable opportunity for all of us, and that is he's going to be taking with some rabbinical students, going to be taking some of the materials that we've developed at YU and make them into what I would call intellectual bite-sized morsels on issues of ethics, on important issues for us as Torah Jews, so that we can share them around North America and they can become the Shabbos conversation. So that we're able to discuss issues like appropriate business practices and to recognize that what gets you into Olam Haba is that you filled out your IRS forms appropriately and that you interacted properly with the business. And then one of the questions it asks you is, Asakta Bapiria Barigia, mistranslated by most as, have you fulfilled the mitzvah of having children? But that's not what the words say. That would be Kiyamta Piria Barigia. Have you fulfilled the mitzvah of Piria Barigia? It says Asakta. Did you work on it? Did you try? It's important to recognize that halacha does not demand for us to use these measures of infertility in order to fulfill the mitzvah period of Arabia.
if you do not fulfill the mitzvah period of Arivia and you've tried, you still get your ticket into Olam Haba. It's not about saying that, oh, if you don't have children and you've tried your best, then you haven't violated any prohibition. And that's why the text, the Talmudic text, is very focused and very accurate. It's always accurate, but very nuanced. And that is, it says not kiyamta, but it says asakta. Did you try to have children? Did you try to fulfill the mitzvah? But let's say a couple wants to go through this process. What are the halachot? First question. Can you destroy the fertilized eggs? Let's say some of them that have genetic anomalies in it. Are you permitted to destroy them? Are you permitted to do these processes? So the first thing that we have to recognize, again, we're on the first page of our handout with the sources, and that is that you have a Masechet Yevamot, and the next two sources, and then the Shulchan Aruch, we're told the following. That until 40 days, the fertilized egg does not yet even have the status of a fetus. It's considered Maya Ba'alma, a stack of water. In fact, in Chicago, I cannot not mention this. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in an article in which he discusses who is the mother of a child, where the egg comes from one mother and the fertilized egg is nurtured in a surrogate mother, a different mother. So the egg comes from one mother, and the nurturing of the egg, the surrogate mother, is a different. You have a donor mother and a surrogate mother. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik clearly says that the definition of maternity is the nurturing mother. Why? Because he says, you look at the mother who's there on the 41st day. On the 41st day, the genetic donor is no longer around. On the 41st day, it is the womb of the surrogate mother that is nurturing this fetus. And therefore, this is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's words. Look at the genetic donor, no different as synthetic matter, and look at it no different as if the egg came from someplace in Japan, made in Japan. Totseret Yapan, he writes. In other words, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik took this idea to its maximum, and he said that the definition of a mother is the one who is involved in the process at the 41st day. This is extremely important. Not this idea of 40 days is extremely important for us, because the whole thing that is being done here, and that is at the blastocyst stage of development, removing the fertilized egg in the third and fourth day of development in the laboratory is pre-40 days. And therefore, halachically, there's no problem whatsoever in being involved in this type of manipulation at this stage within the fertilized egg. Because for two reasons. One is it's less than 40 days, and secondly, it's not yet within the womb. And since in the laboratory, the fertilized egg can never develop into a human being, can never develop in any way, shape, or form, there's no halakhic problem whatsoever. That's why there's another interesting halakha, and that is, if a woman has a miscarriage, the next child is not, you don't do a pidyon habenah, except if the miscarriage happened less than 40 days. Because it's not considered fruit of the womb if it miscarried before 40 days. It's only considered fruit of the womb if it miscarried after 40 days. Again, that is the line in the sand. And by the way, again, not going into all the medicine, but if you look at various the development of the fetus, you will see that on the 40th day, although it has a heartbeat, the fetus has a heartbeat before the 40th day, the development of the fetus takes on human qualities at that 40th day. Look at Netter's slides and others on that, and you'll see that the 40th day is actually a line in the sand that you actually even see from a medical perspective. So the first thing to realize is that since all of these procedures are having less than 40 days, halacha is not very concerned about them. And therefore, if you turn to the next page of our handout, you'll see Rav Chaim Davar HaLevi was a Sephardic chief rabbi in Tel Aviv from 1924 to 1998, writes the following. He writes that he writes in the handout that hopefully, just want to make sure where I have it asterisked. He writes the following: in a hospital that is found in one of the major areas for religious Jews in New York, which by the way, this hospital is Maimonides that he's writing about, and they're dealing with IVF procedures, and that it's permitted for them to do IVF procedures. He writes the following: that any of the fertilized eggs that are not going to be returned, there is no prohibition whatsoever to destroy them. And by the way, there's no issue of Chilul Shabbos for them. What does that mean? If a woman is pregnant, even if she's less than 40 days old, the halacha is that you rush her to the hospital, you do whatever you can to save the fetus. But let's say, for some strange reason, you have a fertilization laboratory, you have a lab that does all issues of fertility, and for somehow all the electricity goes out, there's no backup generators or anything else like that. And the cryopreservation state has been challenged on these fertilized eggs. On Shabbos, are you allowed to drive to the lab to save these fertilized eggs? The answer is no. Because since in that location they can never become human beings, the heter of saving a fetus less than 40 days old only applies within the womb, where the fertilized egg, where the fetus will develop into a human being. But in a laboratory, since a lab you can never develop into a human being, then there is no permission to violate Shabbos in order to be able to save the fertilized eggs. I'm going to take questions afterwards. I just need to get to my point, to the point. I apologize. My point here is the following. I'm just trying to bring home a message. And that is any work that is done, any manipulation that is done less than 40 days, is not a halakhic challenge whatsoever. And furthermore, that is also highlighted in the next source. In the next source, you have the following. You have Rav Zilberstein, also one of the major poskim in issues of medical ethics, where he writes the following: Otam beitziyot hapikiyah lamachala, any fertilized eggs that have in it some type of illness, mutar shelo lashtilam, you don't have to return them to the womb, mutar af lashmidam, and you can also destroy them, ve'en bekach isur. There's no isur whatsoever because they don't have a din of nefesh yet. They're not within the womb. There's no problem. It's not considered abortion in any way, shape, or form. In the Nishmat Avraham, which is on the same sheet but on the left-hand side, Professor Abraham discusses a conversation that he had with Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, before he passed away. And the problem was the following, and that is issues of hemophilia. At those times, what they would do is they would do a sperm wash in order to make sure that they would separate the X and Y chromosomes, in order to make sure that they would only have female children, because hemophilia was a less of a challenge with female children than it is with male children. Just the opposite. They would want to have. They would want to have. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, they want to have female children and not male children. So. To the very early point this morning. So the question is, they asked Rav Shlomo Zalman, is it permitted to do this sperm selection in order to make sure that you won't have female children, not male children? Rav Shlomo Zalman said, quotes the Gemara, "Bahadei kafsei d'rachman olamali." Who gives you the right to enter into the domain of God? Who gives you the right to enter in the domain of God? There are certain things. We are not God. We are God's partners. We are not God. The minute you start deciding whether you have male or female children, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you're starting to enter the domain of God, not being partners with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. But then he ends, and that's what I have underlined there, then he ends with the following comment. He ends with the following notion. In order to obviate pain, in order to make sure you have healthy children, you're allowed to enter into the domain of God in order to be able to save a child from having certain medical challenges. So while Shlomo Zalman puts up a question flag of using a sperm wash to decide whether he had male or female children, he ends his conversation with the Nishmas Avraham saying that he had no problem doing it if it is to be able to stop somebody from having a child that has medical issues. With this in mind, I want to just share with you and then summarize a series of responsa, unpublished responsa, regarding this issue of deciding to have male or female children through PGD. Before we get to that, let's just summarize what we've said till now. We said the following. We introduced the idea of what PGD is. We discussed, we gave two stories, and these are, again, these are not stories that are made up. One happened just this week, one happened, you know, many years ago. But they are stories that happen every single day, that male or female children, based on certain social issues, or to be able to decide to use PGD in order to obviate genetic challenges. We mentioned that on one level, there's no halakhic problem with doing these types of procedures because it's being done on genetic material that's less than 40 days old, that does not have the status of a fetus, even if it was in the womb of the woman, surely in the laboratory, where the genetic material could never develop into a human being. We now put one flag up, which is that of Rav Shlomo Zalman, who reminded us that there's a meta-halakhic issue. That meta-halakhic issue is one of you have to be careful about treading into the domain of God. So the question is, does one bifurcate this issue in the following way, that perhaps when it comes to genetic issues, PGD, deciding whether you'll have healthy children or not based on genetic issues, is okay because you can tread into the domain of God for that. But to decide whether you have male or female children because you're afraid that your child's going to be called up as a Yisrael and it's not going to make you look good because you're a Kohen, or you only have bedrooms painted in blue and you only you want to have a male child, or you want to be able to fill the mitzvah per revu, or, you know, you have a certain amount of names, you've given out all the girl names already, you did all the b'nai salacha, now you want to do some of the boy names. You know, maybe there, you're entering into the domain of God, and it's not permitted. So, Rav Menachem Verstein, who is the head of Mechon Pua, a wonderful Mechon, which is interesting, because it has the respect from the most Dati Tzioni community to the most Haredi communities. They interact with everybody, and they're really respected by everybody. Send this out to a series of poskim, and regarding the following thing, and that is, that's the next page. There are three different ways in which you can help trying to decide whether you have a male or female child. One is by having a certain diet, and that he writes has a 60-75% chance. The truth is, I think his numbers are way off. It's maybe at best a 30% chance. Then, at best, the second way is you can do a sperm wash, and that has 60%. He writes 85% chance. I think it's less than that. And then the third way is by doing PGD. You use IVF, and in Israel, IVF is much cheaper than it is in America. In fact, there are people who said that the Ministry of Tourism should do ads, like, you know, come to Israel, do IVF, have a child, see the country, and for $5,000 you can do everything, as opposed to here it costs $15,000. So, and then you do PGD with it, and you get 100%. It's foolproof. And then do that. Is it permitted to use PGD, this pre-implementation genetic diagnosis, to decide whether you want to have male or female children? So he has a few different answers. So let's turn to the next page. Reb Nevensal, the major Torah personality of the Old City. He says the first way is definitely okay, using the diet. He says, because there's no hashchasa zera. He says the second way, sperm wash, is even better than the third way. He doesn't really give an answer what he thinks about the third way. Rav Amar, the chief rabbi, who Rabbi Freundel and I have had some interactions with, Rabbi Freundel more than myself, a wonderful man. He writes that this is a real problem because, you know, the Isser of Kalayim, according to the Ramban, of not mixing different species is to remind us that we are not God, that we cannot create new species. And he says, you're treading into the same ideas when you you're going to decide whether you have male or female children. Well, now you're going to get a menu. Do you want blonde-haired kids, blue-eyed kids? Do you want brown, curly, not curly hair? I mean, you know, it gets to a point where, I'm not saying that all is genetically possible to determine by PGD, but my point is that it gets to a point where there's a shela here regarding whether you have a right to be involved in mass separation. However, he does not end like that. He says, "Kishiyeh shelam yuchedet." Let's say you have many girls and not boys. Then you have to ask a permission that maybe in a case in which, well, for its medicine, or to fulfill puravu, or for shalom bayis, it might be permitted. To orchestrate your family, it's not. But, you know, that's leaving a gap of permission that a Mack truck can go through. If it's medical, if you want to fulfill the mitzvah of puravu, or there's shalom bayis, you should ask the shayla about it. But if it's just for family orchestration, then it's a little bit of a problem. Then you have Rav Neuvid. Rav Neuvid wrote a very famous sefer. What is it called?
Shmir
Shabbos Kol Chasa. So Rav Neuvid writes the following. I'm bothered that you're working on these issues. I thought that your job was to work in issues of fertility. We have to do what else? And then let everything in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. But by the way, if you really want to know my feeling on this, look at what was written by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal. At this point, Rav Shlomo Zalman is no longer alive. In the Nishmas Avram. And the Nishmas Avram, as we read together, right, says that for medical reasons, you know, entering into the pastures of a Kaddish Baruch Hu seems to be permitted. Then let's turn to the next page. You have Rav Ariel. A little hard to read this. But basically, Rav Ariel says is that if you're going to have a child who will be a Baal Hum, then it's definitely mutter l'tatkila to use PGD. Then you have others who, like the famous Sephardic Rav Mashuz, who he writes, you know, he basically starts off with the gematria, Ezer equals Zera, which equals Harim. Having male children equals Ana Hashem Atzlichana. But then he says, at the end, I don't really have time to answer this question because I'm doing gematrias here, but the Shita Rishona is definitely permitted, the diet, right? It's no different than all the Gemaras that we mentioned earlier. The second one and the third one looks like you're entering into, you're interfering with God. However, to stop a child from having certain physical challenges, it should be mutter to work with all of them. So, in conclusion, when it comes to the issues of PGD, I'd like to, you know, say the following. And that is that we're at the stage within halakhic development, I think this is fair to say, that really there isn't one ironclad approach to this yet, because this is still, the halakhic conversations of this are still in flux, are still developing. But what is clear is, to use PGD in order to be a Kaddish Baruch Hu's partner, and recognize that science is a gift that has been given to us to alleviate suffering within a family, is definitely halakhically permitted. The question is whether it is permitted to orchestrate one's family, to have male children, female children. There's more than enough from the letters I just showed you that would suggest that it's also okay. I personally, in an article that I wrote in Tradition, which, if you want to read, you're more than welcome to read afterwards, I'm very concerned about that. And again, recognizing the fact that the people who did it, what they forgot, I will never know, recognizing that fact, that I'm concerned about the fact that we have to be careful about using science in effective ways to achieve wonderful goals. And my concern is that once we start orchestrating the use of science in order to make sure that we fill the mitzvah puravu, male and female children, not for medical issues, but just for other issues, or because of sociological challenges, and not to belittle the psychological and sociological challenges that would go on for this man who has this issue regarding the fact that he will be frowned upon because he has a male child, not a female child. Well, there are many poskim that were permitted, and I'm not a posek. I would be concerned about starting to use this type of science in order to deal with those issues. But clearly, for issues that help with medical challenges, and here in some ways I'm not being fully honest, because one could say that psychological challenges are clearly medical challenges also. So I'm showing you that there is a wide range here, but I wanted to show you the journey that halacha is taking on this issue. This, unlike cloning, which is an important issue, and we can discuss it, and there's a lot of issues to discuss with cloning, when the genetic material comes from one person, when the other material comes from another person, when there's a whole bunch of stuff going on with cloning, and mammals and other things of that nature. But I'm talking about, this is day-to-day stuff. New York Magazine came out with the top doctors in the New York tri-state area. Right by the list of who were the best fertility specialists, there are ads. And every ad, it says IVF done in our lab and PGD done in our lab. This is done every place. And so the question is, how can PGD be used? We explored the basics of the medicine. We discussed a little bit about the philosophical. We went through the one or two of the halakhic issues, the meta-halakhic issue, and also recognized the other challenge. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to thank the Rabbi. We're going to take a 1 minute break because we're running a little bit tight on schedule. 1 minute break, then Rabbi Freundel will get started. 1 minute break, then we'll talk about President Obama's health care. No, I'm just kidding.
Actually, yes. Read what episode of the water. Are you ready?
Hell yeah.